Robert Durst's wife, Kathy McCormick Durst, went missing in 1982. Robert Durst's close friend, Susan Berman, was killed in 2000. And in 2001, the dismembered remains of 71-year-old Morris Black were found by a young teenage boy and his father, who were fishing in Galveston Bay in Texas. Inside various garbage bags were the torso and limbs, everything but the head, which has never been found. A piece of newspaper also found inside the bags had a sticker with a delivery address on it, which led investigators to an apartment building nearby. Morris Black was one of four residents who lived there. Another resident was Robert Durst, although authorities didn't know that at first, because he was living there as a woman named Dorothy Siner. They were able to piece together that Dorothy Siner was actually Robert Durst, and they also connected Durst to the gun that had killed Black. Durst was charged with murder, but he posted bond in the amount of $300,000 and then went on the run. He was later apprehended in Pennsylvania while attempting to shoplift Band-Aids, a newspaper, and a chicken salad sandwich. He had over $500 in his pocket and $37,000 in his car, along with two guns and marijuana. In 2003, Durst went to trial for Black's murder. Prosecutors said that Durst murdered Black because Black had figured out his identity, and Durst was afraid that he was going to be arrested for his wife Kathy's disappearance. Durst's defense team, meanwhile, said Durst and Black had a violent life-or-death struggle over a gun that Black had threatened to kill Durst with. The struggle ended with the gun going off and shooting Black in the face. They told the jury that Durst was traumatized, got drunk, and cut up the body before disposing of it in the bay. On the stand, Durst said he didn't remember cutting up the body and that he had downed a fifth of Jack Daniels. The jury appeared to either buy Durst's story or, perhaps more likely, had enough reasonable doubt, and they found him not guilty of murder. The following is from an ABC News report at the time.
In Galveston, Texas today, a very high-profile murder trial ended with a verdict that was so surprising the defendant appeared to be caught off guard. Texas is one of the toughest states to escape a murder charge, but Robert Durst was not the typical defendant. He's the heir to one of New York's largest real estate fortunes. Here's ABC's Dan Harris.
With the jury, find the defendant, Robert Durst, not guilty.
Robert Durst made no effort to hide his relief at the verdict. The evidence against him was damning. Durst admitted to shooting and killing his neighbor and then cutting his body to pieces with a saw. Prosecutors portrayed Durst as a cold-blooded murderer who killed Morris Black to steal his identity so Durst could hide from investigators who suspected him in the disappearance of his wife and the murder of another friend. Durst and his high-priced, high-powered attorneys argued that he killed Morris Black by accident, that the two had struggled over a gun when Durst found Black illegally inside his apartment. It worked.
Robert Durst did plead guilty to skipping bond, evidence tampering, which included dismembering the body, and taking a gun across state lines while on the run. He was sentenced to 5 years in prison, with credit for time served. But his legal problems didn't end there. In 2015, he was finally arrested for his friend Susan Berman's murder. Fast forward to the summer of 2021, and Durst was again at trial, facing down a life sentence for murder. Would he get the same break in this case as he did in the Morris Black one? In part one, I covered the evidence the prosecution presented as it pertains to Kathy's disappearance and Susan's murder. If you haven't listened to that yet, I highly suggest doing that before listening to part two. Today, I'll continue with the prosecution's case, and then we'll hear from the defendant himself. And at the end, I'll go over some recent updates, as of this recording, that have already taken place. Remember, in this episode, Robert Durst is on trial for Susan's murder, but evidence regarding his involvement in Kathy's disappearance and Morris Black's death was allowed in. This is Jillian, and in partnership with Law and Crime, you are listening to Court Junkie, Episode 178, Part 2. At the trial for Susan's murder, testimony from the trial for Morris Black's killing was introduced to the jury. This included transcripts from the testimonies of the landlord where Black and Durst lived, the medical examiner, and even Durst himself. While on the stand at the trial for Black's death, Durst had said that on September 30th, 2011, he arrived at home to his apartment to find Black sitting inside, watching TV. He said Black had a look on his face that he thought meant Black was angry with him. He said he immediately was afraid that Black had stolen his gun that Durst kept in his oven. When he asked Black where the gun was, he said Black stood up and pointed it at him. Durst said they never really wrestled, but that he grabbed the gun and the two men tripped and fell to the ground. The gun then went off and Black was dead. Durst said he panicked and thought the police would never believe him. He ended up dismembering and disposing of the body. Blood spatter expert Tom Bevel, who also testified at the prior trial, said at this trial that he did not agree with how the defense said the altercation between Durst and Black occurred. He also said that because they were never able to find Black's head, he couldn't reconstruct the scene properly to really tell what happened. There was a small delay in the trial on Tuesday, July 13th. According to his attorney, Durst was incontinent and had diarrhea. He was foul and had to go back to the jail to be cleaned up. As a result, the trial didn't start that day until well into the afternoon. Susan Giordano was close to Robert Durst. According to her, they had a platonic relationship, just friends. But right off the bat, Prosecutor Lewin challenged her on this.
Do you love Bob Durst?
Absolutely.
Have you told him repeatedly that you love him?
Absolutely.
Do you tell him repeatedly in phone calls that you miss him?
Yes.
Do you talk about, in the numerous phone calls you've had with him, spending your rest of your lives together?
Yes.
Do you talk about living together in the same house together?
Yes.
And is it your opinion, ma'am, that that is the definition of a platonic, just friendly relationship?
Yes.
She testified that over the course of their 20-year friendship, Durst had given her more than $350,000. But she said their friendship wasn't based on finances. In March 2015, he sent her a check for $300,000. Also in March 2015, she sent Durst a suitcase full of his clothes to him in New Orleans. She testified that she didn't look at the bottom of the suitcase. She saw papers there but didn't touch them, and she packed his clothes on top of them. Investigators would learn during their investigation that there was $115,000 in cash in the bottom of that suitcase. At the time, prosecutors say Durst was in New Orleans because he was on the run before his most recent arrest for Susan's murder. Susan Giordano also stored 64 boxes with financial documents and communications between Durst and his attorneys at her home. They were later taken by authorities. Prosecutor Lewin pointed out that she had an attorney from New York with her in court as she testified. She had retained that attorney shortly after Durst was arrested for Susan Berman's murder.
Who's paying for that attorney?
Actually, that was supposed to come from money that Bob had given me a long time ago. And he hasn't been paid as of yet.
Ma'am, would the answer be that Bob Durst is paying for that attorney?
Well, it came from money but I still owe the lawyer money right now. I don't
Ma'am, so is it your understanding that you will be paying the lawyer the money out of your pocket, or that Mr. Durst will be paying or reimbursing?
Honestly, my lawyer didn't even ask anything as of now, so I don't know. I don't know yet.
Ma'am, I'm not asking what your lawyer asked you. I'm saying, is it your understanding, as you sit here today, is it your belief that Mr. Durst is paying for your lawyer?
Yes.
She testified that that attorney had told her to give him any bills she owes, and so she did. Those bills were then paid. She said she never asked how they were paid.
Ma'am, so you're telling this jury that you have a lawyer that's being paid for by Mr. Durst. That lawyer is telling you, just give me these bills, and you're saying you had no idea that Mr. Durst is behind paying them.
I could assume anything, but I didn't see anything. Like I said, I didn't ask.
While Durst was in jail awaiting this trial, he had several recorded phone calls with Susan Giordano. In one of them, he says, "They're all in agreement that I can support you. I can pay off your debts. I was concerned last time we spoke. They were upset because you were doing something. That's not the case at all. What their concern is that Lewin will try to charge you with being some kind of accessory."
Ma'am, so was your understanding correct that you were going to be getting money from Mr. Durst's representatives? Mr. Durst, you were expecting more money to be coming, correct?
Yes.
Okay, ma'am. At that point, you were aware that you were going to be testifying in this case. You knew that you were going to be either called as a witness by the prosecution or potentially as a witness for the defense, correct?
Yes.
Did you see any issue, ma'am, with your objectivity, with receiving money from Mr. Durst when you knew that you were going to be testifying in court, potentially as his witness?
Yes. So that's why I never told him how much I would have needed, to make sure that I told him at some other point, some other time. I just...
Ma'am?
I didn't get a check. That's how it ended.
Ma'am, at any point, did you tell Bob Durst, don't send me money?
No, I just kept telling him we'll talk.
In another call, they discuss getting a love nest when he gets out of jail. The prosecution played for the jury a movie called All Good Things, which was reportedly inspired by Robert Durst's life. The movie starred Ryan Gosling and Kirsten Dunst, and Gosling, who plays Durst, is suspected of 3 murders. In a prior interview with the prosecutor, Durst had said that he liked the movie's depiction of himself. In addition to the jury viewing the movie All Good Things, they also viewed parts of the HBO series The Jinx, The Life and Deaths of Robert Durst. On its website, it's described as a 6-part examination of the reclusive millionaire at the heart of 3 killings spanning 4 decades. Andrew Jarecki had previously directed All Good Things, and after the movie was released, he reportedly got a call from Robert Durst, who offered to be interviewed, which was how The Jinx was born. The series investigated the disappearance of Kathy Durst and the killings of Susan Berman and Morris Black. At the end of episode 5, Susan Berman's stepson contacts Jarecki and gives him an envelope Durst had sent to Susan in 1999. The handwriting on that envelope matched the so-called cadaver note that we heard about in Prosecutor Lewin's opening statements earlier in the episode. Remember, someone had sent the police a note with Susan's address and had written cadaver on it. And when police responded to that address, they found Susan's body. Well, not only did the handwriting from the envelope match the handwriting on the cadaver note, But the word Beverly was misspelled the same way on both. Susan Giordano, that very close friend of Durst, was questioned about this episode by Prosecutor Lewin. In fact, after this episode aired, Prosecutor Lewin said Durst fled.
Isn't it true that you told Andrew Jarecki that Bob Durst told you that, in essence, things were going bad and he had to get away?
Yes, I didn't consider it fleeing. I just thought he was coming to New York, and he was jumping to conclusions. So he was not really fleeing. If you're coming back to New York, I didn't.
Ma'am, so yes. When you said to him, everything's going to go bad, you didn't take that as meaning he was fleeing?
No, I just thought he was jumping to conclusions.
Well, ma'am, you had watched episode 5 of The Jinx, correct?
I did see parts of it.
Ma'am, you knew when you were talking to Mr. Durst that in episode 5, that was when he had been confronted with the cadaver note and the Sarab note, correct?
Right.
Ma'am, you agree that back at that time, Mr. Durst was completely denying authorship of the cadaver note, correct?
Correct.
And you were aware of that, correct?
Yes.
And when you saw episode 5 and you saw him being confronted with these two notes that looked the same, which he's now actually admitted that he wrote, you realized, ma'am, that that was a problem for Mr. Durst, correct?
I can't. I can't say. No.
You did not realize that was a problem?
No.
So when you just gave that statement where you're quoting him as saying, I have to leave because this is, you know, it's going to be, everything's going to go bad. And I said to him that he was jumping to conclusions that the case was opened a long time ago. Ma'am, what else could the reasonable interpretation be of that exchange other than Bob Durst is telling you he's in big trouble and you're trying to reassure him? Well, it's not that bad.
I can't say. Can't open this. I thought it was going to look bad.
She said he told her he was going to New York, but then she said he called her and he was in New Orleans. In the 6th episode of The Jinx, director Andrew Jarecki takes the writing samples to a forensic document examiner who confirms that one person wrote both envelopes. When Jarecki interviews Durst again and confronts him about it, Durst again insists that he did not write the cadaver note. Afterwards, Durst goes into the bathroom, still wearing his microphone. In the episode, you can hear him say to himself, "What the hell did I do?" Killed them all, of course. This made headlines everywhere, as people speculated that he had made a bathroom confession. At trial, however, we learned that the producers had actually edited what he had said and had put the two phrases together. Instead, he had said, "killed them all, of course," several minutes before saying, "what the hell did I do?" On the night of the airing of that 6th and final episode of The Jinx, Durst was arrested in New Orleans and charged with Susan's murder. In May 2015, while Durst was in jail awaiting trial, he spoke with a friend of his named Jeannie Clark. Their phone call was recorded. In it, Durst said that he never should have spoken to that schmuck, referring to Jarecki. He said that after watching the 4th episode, he started to think I had a problem. In a later recorded phone call with Clark, he said he needs to find a friend who would testify that he never misspelled Beverly, saying that would be very helpful. Jeannie Clark's recorded video testimony was played for the jury. She often can't recall things, and at one point, when asked about the jinx, she asked, "Who's the jinx?" Without the jury present, another hearing was held in the courtroom. This time, the defense filed a motion for a mistrial, saying that Durst's health was so bad that he was unable to testify in his own defense. And since everyone has a right to testify, they wanted a mistrial. They brought a doctor to the stand who testified that Durst could die if he testified and that he should be hospitalized right now. The judge took it under advisement, but ultimately denied the motion, saying he has endured 11 weeks of trial, but remains mentally present. And so not only would the trial continue, but Robert Durst would take the stand. In his opening statements, Robert Durst's attorney, Dick DeGaren, was sure to tell the jury that Durst had previously been acquitted of Morris Black's murder.
On November the 11th, 2003, a jury that looked a lot like you, people from all walks of life, 12 people found Bob Durst not guilty.
According to DeGaren, after Black's death, Durst wanted to clear his name. And so after watching All Good Things, he reached out to Andrew Jarecki, who started interviewing him for The Jinx.
And the result was the series, The Jinx. Now, some people call it a documentary. It's not a documentary. It doesn't pretend to be a documentary, but it's called one. It was a series of programs that ran in early 2015. By the time of the fifth segment, there were six segments. By the time of the fifth segment, it became obvious to Bob that this was a hatchet job, that it wasn't his story as he wanted it told. It was a heavily edited story to make good entertainment. And in fact, it won an Emmy. But after the fifth segment, Bob again panicked.
He said Durst left his apartment in Houston with a gun, a mask, and fake ID, and drove to New Orleans. He rented a hotel room and watched episode 6 there. That's the one with the heavily edited bathroom tape, DeGaren said.
What the evidence will show is that Bob finally realized what Jarecki and his crew were trying to show, that he killed them all. He knew he'd been fooled.
He said Durst made the mistake of calling his answering service to get his messages. And as soon as he did that, the FBI was able to trace him, and they arrested him, charging him with Susan's murder.
The only case before you to determine a verdict is the murder of Susan Berman. The evidence is lacking. The evidence isn't there. Bob Durst did not kill Susan Berman, and he doesn't know who did. Bob, did you kill Susan Berman?
No.
Do you know who did?
No, I do not.
78-year-old Robert Durst was on the stand, answering questions for his attorney, Dick DeGaren. After those initial questions, Durst told the court about his health problems, his childhood, and how he met Kathy and Susan. He said the last time he saw Kathy was when he dropped her off at a train station in Westchester on January 31st, 1982. He said he and Kathy had just spent the weekend together at their cottage, and she was going to their apartment on the Upper West Side. She was starting a new rotation the following morning. That week, he said he ran his normal errands, like dropping their dog off to the vet and looking at houses in Connecticut. He said it wasn't unusual for Kathy to stay overnight at the school at times.
Was she able to stay at the school for, say, maybe a day or two or three in a row while she was doing these 24-hour shifts?
Yes, there were various places where Kathy could stay and our relationship. As it had gone downhill, she had spent more time not coming home.
So was it unusual for you at this time not to hear from Kathy or not?
It was not unusual.
So were you worried that first night when you didn't hear from her?
No, I was not worried at all.
He told the jury that he didn't know anything was wrong until later in the week when he got a voicemail from a woman at Kathy's school saying that Kathy hadn't been in and that she was in jeopardy of receiving an incomplete on her work. He admitted to lying to investigators when he initially told them that he had called Kathy on the night she disappeared and that she had made it to their apartment. He also admitted that he had lied about going to the neighbor's house for a drink after dropping Kathy off. He said it seemed like the detective wanted him to tell him that he had done stuff after taking Kathy to the train station. I sort of told him what I felt like he wanted to hear, he said. He testified that he was concerned that Kathy had a cocaine addiction and that she was ditching her schoolwork due to that. But he said it never dawned on him that something could have happened to her.
It was more like, what had Kathy done to Kathy?
And when you say, what had Kathy done to Kathy, what do you mean your concern was?
The cocaine and the alcohol.
He finally called the police to report Kathy missing on Thursday, February 4th. But he said the lady on the phone didn't take him seriously. According to him, she said with a giggle, "Have you checked with your wife's boyfriend?" She then told him he had to check with all of his wife's relatives and then report her missing in person. He said he called Kathy's brother and told him what was going on. On Friday, he said he was worried that something had happened to her and went to the police station to report her missing. He said other than talking to her friends and family, he didn't know what else to do. He said Susan offered to take calls from reporters regarding Kathy's disappearance, and she told him he should hire a PR firm. He told the court that he wasn't publicly considered a suspect at the time, but 18 years later, that changed. In October 2000, Janine Pierrot, the Westchester County, New York District Attorney at the time, announced that she was reopening the investigation. Durst recalled seeing her on television, publicly saying, "I'm going to get Robert Durst, one way or another." He said he was very concerned and scared.
Why were you scared?
Well, when I saw this little lady said, "I'm going to get Durst, Robert Durst, one way or another," that was very scary.
He said he flew to Dallas, then drove to Galveston and rented a cheap apartment. He planned on hiding out there.
What plan did you make about hiding?
I disguised myself as a woman. I rented an apartment.
Tell the jury how you did that. How did you think to disguise yourself as a woman?
I put on a wig.
Where'd you get the wig?
At a wig store.
Where?
In Dallas.
And how did you dress?
Well, I got a big sweatshirt and cargo pants. I shaved real good.
What about your voice?
You know, my voice is very recognizable. I knew I would not be able to speak to anybody, so I wrote on a 3x5 card, "I am mute." Anyone who spoke to me, I would show them the card.
He said he met Morris Black on the first night he was there. Morris tried talking to him, but he pulled out his card that said, "I am mute," and walked away. He described driving over to Susan Berman's house on December 22, 2000, from Northern California to her house in Beverly Hills. When he was about 2 hours away, he said he started to get a migraine, and so he pulled off to stay at a motel in Bakersfield. He said he called Susan at around 11 p.m. from the motel. He testified that twice during their conversation, Susan interrupted him to talk to someone else who was there. He took a Percocet for his migraine, which he said made him feel hungover and groggy the following day. The next morning, he said he left the motel and drove the remaining 2 hours to Susan's. That's when he found her dead, on the floor of her bedroom. He told the court that he at first thought she had fainted, but when he put his hand over her nose and mouth, he said her breath felt cold. He tried lifting her up by her arms and then dropped her after seeing a puddle of liquid around her head. He testified that he believed the killer was still inside the house. He left and called 911 from a payphone, but didn't give his name. He told the jury that he did write the cadaver note, but that he didn't kill Susan. He knew it would be hard to believe, and so he lied about it. He said on the stand that he has difficulty believing it himself. As for Morris Black, Durst's attorneys, Dick DeGuerin and David Chesnoff, got up and did a reenactment of what Durst said happened between them. As the two attorneys pretended to struggle over a gun, falling to the ground in the front of the courtroom, some spectators couldn't help but laugh.
Where's the television camera?
This is my favorite part of the whole trial so far.
I don't know who to root for here.
Durst then testified that he dismembered the body because he didn't think anyone would believe him that he had killed him in self-defense. And as for that so-called bathroom confession from the Jinx, he said, "What I did not say out loud, or perhaps I said very softly, is, they'll all think I killed them all, of course."
So, Mr. Durst, Mr. DeGuerin called you Bob. So you tell me, how do you want me to refer to you? I'm comfortable doing it however you want to do it. Do you want me to call you Bob? Do you want me to call you Mr. Durst? What would you prefer?
How about sir?
Okay, I'll call you sir.
Prosecutor John Lewin cross-examined Robert Durst. He accused Durst of lying multiple times to multiple people, all to help himself. Durst agreed he did lie sometimes for various reasons, including to get himself out of trouble.
Would you lie under oath to help your case?
Yes.
Okay. Have you lied thus far during your testimony at this trial?
No.
But if you had lied, given your last answer, you might not admit it, correct?
Correct.
On direct examination, do you remember the first thing that Mr. DeGuerin asked you?
He asked me if I killed Susan Berman.
Did you know that question was coming?
Yes.
And you denied it, is that right?
I said no.
If, in fact, you had killed her, would you tell us?
No.
He said the same about Kathy and Morris Black.
All right, I want to talk about Kathy for a moment. Do you miss her?
Yes.
Tell me about her.
When I think about Kathy, I miss Kathy.
What was she like?
She was very lively. And up until the last year of our marriage, she was very happy.
Would you agree she was a very bright young woman?
Yes.
Beautiful?
Yes.
He was asked to describe his relationship with Kathy. He said in the beginning, they were in love. Prosecutor Lewin asked if he agreed that he was extremely controlling in their relationship, and he said no. Lewin then played a prior interview where Durst said he was always very, very, very controlling. They went back and forth like this for a while. Prosecutor Lewin would ask him if something was true, Durst would deny it, and then Lewin would replay an interview or even direct testimony where Durst said the opposite. Durst said he was confused or just plain didn't remember.
You have made an issue during your cross-examination at times when I have confronted you with statements you have made. You have said, and I'm paraphrasing, I'm not normal. I'm told I'm on the autism spectrum. Do you recall saying that?
Yeah.
Would you agree, Mr. Durst? I just want to make sure. You're not blaming your alleged autism spectrum disorder for your conduct in this case, are you?
What do you mean, my conduct in this case?
So as an example, you've admitted to repeated perjury. That's not because you're on the spectrum, correct?
Well, maybe it is.
So you're blaming the fact that you come into court and you've repeatedly lied under oath, and you're telling this jury that you're not responsible for that. That's because you're on the spectrum. Is that your testimony?
Sure, why not?
Do you believe that's true? Do you believe that autism, being on the spectrum, a serious disease or condition that many people have to deal with, do you believe that somehow that makes you into a liar?
Sure.
Lewin asked if there would be any reasonable scenario to support a theory Durst had brought up earlier, that Kathy had potentially initially run away and then was maybe killed months or years later.
You want a reasonable one?
Yes, I want a reasonable scenario.
She was with her boyfriend for 6 months and then her boyfriend killed her.
Which boyfriend would that be?
I did not know who her boyfriends were.
So she went off with her boyfriend, abandoned a divorce with a wealthy person, and decided 2 months short of medical school that she was just going to give it up. Does that sound reasonable to you?
In the context of what we're doing, I'm going to say it's reasonable.
In the context of what we're doing, does that mean you up here on the stand telling crazy stories that you can't support? I mean, correct?
You're asking me to tell crazy.
I think it's argumentative. I think that is argumentative, so I will not allow an answer.
Mr. Durst, I'm asking you if that scenario that you just described, that your wife, a few months short of graduating from medical school, potentially getting divorced and going to get a settlement from you of money, that she would, quote, take off with her boyfriend for 6 months, not finish medical school, not divorce you and get any money, and then just apparently die in some unrelated fashion. Does that sound reasonable to you?
Maybe they went on a cruise.
He said both he and Kathy had affairs. One of his was with Prudence Farrow, sister of Mia Farrow. He said the affair started before Kathy disappeared and lasted until after. He agreed that he had previously said his feelings for Prudence were more than what he felt for other women he had had affairs with, but he now said that wasn't true. He said Kathy knew about his affair with Prudence.
In fact, didn't you have, at one point, Mr. Durst, didn't you arrange for Prudence to speak with Kathy to try and influence Kathy to divorce you?
No.
Isn't it true, Mr. Durst, that you wanted to pursue a relationship with Prudence, but that Kathy Durst, your wife, was in the way?
No.
Did you want to pursue a relationship with Prudence?
Depends when you're talking about.
Okay, when did you, before Kathy disappeared, did you want to pursue a relationship with Prudence?
Yes.
At one point, Durst said something about not knowing where Kathy was buried, which Prosecutor Lewin picked up on and went back to a little later.
Mr. Durst, why did you say you never said you knew where Kathy was buried? How do you know Kathy's buried at all?
Same logical step.
Well, Mr. Durst, would you agree that you talking about the fact that Kathy was buried would seem, Mr. Durst, you would agree, to be implying that you know, in fact, that she was buried, correct?
Overruled?
I was telling you what I thought you wanted to hear.
He agreed he can't explain what he said. After Kathy's disappearance, Kathy's sister reportedly found a piece of paper in the garbage at one of Durst's homes. The note read, "Town dump, bridge, dig, boat, other, shovel or question mark, check car-truck/rent. On the stand, Prosecutor Lewin said it looks like a list to get rid of a body. Durst admitted that he had written that note, but said it wasn't for that. He said he was going to tell the high school kid who took care of the house to take their rotting sailboat to the town dump. The dig, he said, was actually short for digital. He said he had purchased a computer that he planned to work on. Prosecutor Lewin played for the jury an interview he did with Durst after his arrest in New Orleans for Susan's murder, where they discussed a potential plea deal. In the interview, they both agreed that Lewin wanted Durst to tell him where Kathy's body was and the details of Susan's death. If I tell you these things, I'm pleading guilty. I'm going to be going back to Los Angeles and doing my time, Durst had said.
Well, Mr. Durst, tell me how that is not a confession to Susan Berman's murder.
It's not a confession. I did not say I killed Susan Berman.
Prosecutor Lewin said he wants Durst to assume that he didn't murder his wife, Kathy. Wouldn't he be mad that Susan was telling people he did?
If Susan Berman is out there and she's telling people, as you've said, that you killed your wife, you told her that, and that she helped you cover it up. If Janine Pirro is looking to charge you, if Janine Pirro talks to Susan Berman, then that's going to mean that Janine Pirro can basically say, I've got Bob Durst's best friend who's been out there for years saying he killed his wife and helped cover it up. Would you agree that even if Susan's statement is untrue, just her going around and saying it and you being aware of it is a tremendous threat to you?
I think that if Susan was formally interviewed, the person doing the interviewing would decide that she's not reliable.
He agreed that prior to her death, Susan told him in a phone call that she had been contacted by police who wanted to talk to her about Kathy's disappearance. But he said he didn't take her seriously, that he figured if she did talk to investigators, they wouldn't think she was credible. Prosecutor Lewin also concentrated much of his cross-examination on how Durst said he came across Susan Berman's body. On direct, Durst had said he put his hands over her nose and mouth and could feel that her breath was cold.
And you would agree that her breath could not have been cold if she was dead, correct? Is that correct?
Her breath could not be cold if she was dead. I don't know. I just don't know.
Mr. Durst, you said you're not a highly intelligent man, but you said you're an intelligent person. Is it your testimony that you don't know whether or not Susan Berman being dead, you're not sure whether or not she could be breathing cold air that you would have felt? You don't know that answer.
I think you're asking me details of something that I never experienced. I put my hand over her face, and it felt cold. And whether I thought it was her breath or her face that was cold, I really don't know. And if I said it was one or the other, I was just speaking my mind.
Lewin also asked Durst about him saying on direct that he believed the killer may have still been inside the house when he found Susan's body.
Would you agree, Mr. Durst, that you are aware, as you testify today, that it is in your interest to try to make it appear that Susan died as close to the time you found her as possible? Would you agree?
That's argument.
No, I would not agree.
So is it your contention that Susan Berman was killed by somebody who was in the house while you were there or around the time that you got there? Is that your contention?
I said the killer might have been in the house when I arrived.
Would you agree, Mr. Durst, that given your observations about Susan's cold face and the black-looking blood, that if the killer were in the house, it would appear as if they stayed there a long time after they killed her?
I have no idea.
Prosecutor Lewin also showed a side-by-side of the cadaver note and stamps that were found inside Susan's home. The stamps on both were identical.
I never knew up until this minute that the stamps in Susan Berman's house were the same kind of stamp that I put on the cadaver note. I don't remember taking a stamp from Susan Berman's house. I also don't remember getting a stamp anyplace else.
So is it fair to say then that when you look at this, you easily could have taken a stamp from Susan's house?
It's possible.
Prosecutor Lewin pointed out that the fact that there's no physical evidence that shows Durst was ever inside Susan's home doesn't mean that he didn't kill her.
Mr. Durst, did you go in the house and touch numerous items?
Yes.
And you would agree that there's no physical evidence that's been recovered that links you to the house, correct?
Correct.
Would you further agree then that the fact that there is no physical evidence that links you to the house doesn't mean you were not in the house, correct?
Objection. I was sustained. In the house.
Lewin asked if he had ever faked or discussed faking any illnesses in either of his homicide cases, the Morris Black case or this one. Durst said no.
In fact, Mr. Durst, isn't it true that your playbook of kind of faking medical conditions goes all the way back to your arrest in Pennsylvania and your trial in Galveston?
I have no playbook of faking medical conditions.
Please put up LADA 130635, please. That's your handwriting, correct, Mr. Durst?
Correct.
And I'm going to read it. It says, correct, if I am wrongfully convicted, I will be an inmate in Texas where all inmate except those with medical reasons work. I would like to know if there is an eye disease or impairment that I could fake. I was once diagnosed as having glaucoma because I did not pay attention to the flashing lights and seemingly missed most of them. Is there a condition or disease that is hard to diagnose except by the symptoms that the patient describes? Please assume that the doctors, many quite elderly who work in the Texas prison, would take other jobs if they were available. Also assume that the equipment is 10 to 15 years old. Obviously, I would not attempt to fake blindness. All that is necessary is that I have some problems. And then you signed the letter and wrote the words color blindness on the side of the letter. Is that correct?
Durst said the only time he ever thought about faking a medical condition was when he wrote that letter. Prosecutor Lewin then played a jailhouse phone call between Durst and Susan Giordano from 2016, where he asks if there are any tests for dementia, like a blood test or anything. She tells him no, only through a psychologist. He says, I'm thinking it's going to be to my advantage to say I'm suffering from dementia.
Mr. Durst, were these lies attempting to manipulate?
I don't see those lies.
You don't see how you were lying when you're saying that it would be to your advantage to say I'm suffering from dementia when you've now just said you are not suffering from dementia? Wouldn't that be a lie?
I think I'm talking hypothetically.
Prosecutor Lewin also included many questions about Morris Black in his cross-examination, asking how Durst could have so calmly described dismembering him back when he was on trial for Black's death.
Would you agree that it appears to be somewhat detached and, frankly, cold?
I don't think anybody would derive anything from me going anyway, like you are doing.
Mr., doesn't it sound like you're almost telling a story as if you were like building a shed, talking about the tools you have, and then you simply go anyway, and then you move on to your next topic? Doesn't it seem a bit out of place when you're talking about the dismemberment of a human being?
Objection. Overruled.
I have no idea how one should talk about a dismemberment.
He was asked if it was difficult to cut up Black's body, and he said he doesn't remember. When asked if he believed the body parts in the garbage bags would sink into the ocean, he said yes.
Do you recall the testimony, Mr. Durst, that the only body part of Morris Black's that was not found was his head? Do you recall that?
I recall that.
You believed that the body parts were going to sink or would be pulled out into the ocean, correct?
I believe they would sink.
That didn't happen, did it?
They floated.
You did not have any understanding of how the tides worked in Galveston Bay at that time, did you?
I never had any understanding about how the tides worked in Galveston Bay, ever.
And in fact, Mr. Durst, you saw the bags after you dumped them. They began to wash up on the shore, correct?
Correct.
And that caused you to panic, didn't it?
I don't know if I panicked.
Well, Mr. Durst, were you aware that inside the bags were, among other things, a newspaper that had the address of where Morris Black lived?
I was not aware of that.
You were concerned, though, Mr. Durst, that if Morris Black's body was recovered, particularly his head, that number one, they would be able to easily identify him, correct?
Correct.
And you were also concerned, Mr. Durst, strike that. You would agree, Mr. Durst, that if they recovered Morris Black's head, that if you had shot him in the back of the head and not the front of the head, that would be revealed, correct?
Correct.
Lewin asked if Durst has any idea what happened to Black's head. Durst said no.
Is it still your testimony that you did not go back and remove the head from the bags when you saw them washing up on shore?
I did not go back and swim around in the ship channel looking for the bag that had the head.
Prosecutor Habib Balian started his closing arguments by telling the jury he thought this day would never come, which brought some chuckles in the courtroom. But although it was a lengthy trial with a number of witnesses, he said this case isn't difficult at all. He said an escalating pattern of domestic violence and control led to Kathy Durst being wiped off the face of this earth. He said Durst then went to his best friend, Susan Berman.
He chose wisely. He knew she would help him, given how fiercely loyal she was, given her moral code, given her loyalty, how she puts loyalty above everything else. And he chose wisely. And together, they embarked on a campaign. They embarked on a campaign to obscure the truth, to lead the investigation in a completely wrong direction. And she called the medical school on his behalf, pretending to be Kathleen Durst. And she sent the police in the wrong direction. Together they did. And she almost got away. He almost got away with it. but for this reinvestigation that happened. And during this reinvestigation, it became public again. The pressure came on again. And what did he do? Like Kathleen Durst, he wiped her away.
He said Susan helped Durst get out of that jam, and what she got was a bullet in the back of her head by her best friend.
This case is easy. Morris Black, and the defendant runs and hides and flees to Galveston. There's only one person who can lead the police to his doorstep, who knows about who he is, who knows apparently about the reinvestigation. And what does he do? Like Kathy, like Susan, he gets wiped off the face of this earth.
He said the case can be summed up in 9 simple words.
But this case, if I wanted to, could be summed up in 9 simple words. It was her or me. I had no choice.
In their closing arguments, Durst's attorney, Dick DeGaren, attacked prosecutors, saying they spent 9 days beating up a sick old man who can't defend himself.
Calculated to cause you to hate him. I wouldn't blame you after seeing what you've seen in this courtroom. For hating Bob Durst.
He said he has known Durst for 20 years and that he's proud to stand before the jury and defend him when no one else would. He said he wouldn't blame the jury if they hate Durst and believe he's a liar. But a liar doesn't equal a killer, he said. They have to bring evidence, and there is no direct evidence.
This case is supposed to be about Susan Berman. But we heard months and months of evidence about a case in Galveston in which I represented Bob Durst, in which 12 good citizens found him not guilty on more evidence than you heard here. You heard only part of the evidence in Galveston.
He said prosecutors went through efforts to demonize Durst so that the jury would overlook the weakness of evidence about Susan. He said Susan made up stories and told different people different things.
Susan always wanted to make herself appear more important. And so she did have a role when Kathy went missing. She became Bob's PR spokesperson because she had experience and she knew people in the business. But she wanted to make herself seem more important. And so she built up her importance in all that.
He told the jury if they have questions about how Kathy died, prosecutors haven't proven their case. If they have questions about whether Susan really made that phone call, prosecutors haven't proven their case, and they have to vote not guilty. Durst's other attorney, David Chesnoff, also gave closing arguments. He said it's a false premise that Susan called Kathy's school, pretending to be her, on Durst's behalf.
There's absolutely no evidence at our trial of any calls between Bob and Susan preceding the call to Dean Cook that got transferred to Dean Cooperman. Not a single record that Bob Durst had any communication with Susan Berman the night of the 31st. That's what it would take. If Susan is calling the next day, Bob would have had to tell her. What evidence did they show to you at all of any communication between Bob Durst and Susan Berman to put this thing together? Nothing. Zero.
How does the conspiracy occur if there are no records, he asked. He said there's no proof beyond a reasonable doubt that Susan was a witness, and the charges require that.
Whatever you may think of their theory, they have not proved it beyond a reasonable doubt. If there was evidence, they would have presented it. That's their responsibility in meeting the burden of proof. If there was a toll call between South Salem, where Bob was, and New York City, where Susan was, there would be phone records, but none exist. If she didn't call, there is no secret. There is nothing to be a witness about. Might be entertaining for a fictional movie. Not entertaining when someone's life's on the line. And there is certainly no evidence beyond a reasonable doubt. None.
The jury deliberated for about 7 hours over 3 days, during which Durst was reportedly in isolation after having come into contact with someone who had the coronavirus. The jury ended up finding him guilty of Susan's murder. He was not present for the verdict. In October 2021, Durst was sentenced to life in prison. Just days later, he contracted COVID-19 himself and was hospitalized and placed on a ventilator. Robert Durst has since been officially charged with second-degree murder for the death of his wife, Kathy Durst. His latest mugshot was taken in his hospital bed. Only time will tell if he will actually be well enough to face trial for Kathy's murder. And that's all for this episode. Again, I'd like to thank Kathy Rusan from Law and Crime for her meticulous note-taking during this trial. Please go ahead and give her a follow on Twitter at Kathy Rusan. She often covers live trials and has a great feed. I'd also love to hear your thoughts on this case. Let me know by joining the conversation on Instagram at Court Junkie, by tweeting me at Court Junkie Pod, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. If you'd like to hear these episodes without the ads and check out additional bonus episodes, go to courtjunkie.com/support, which will take you to my Patreon page. My latest bonus episode at the $6 and $10 levels is about the Jeffrey Paschal trial. Jeffrey Paschal was best known from 90 Day Fiancé before the 90 days, but he recently went on trial for domestic assault and kidnapping. Again, you can check that out at courtjunkie.com/support at the $6 and $10 levels. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.